It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, take a look at your stuff. We'll talk about the value of prized possessions and family heirlooms and what makes us feel connected to particular items. First, museums have been one of the many institutions hit hard by the pandemic, but they've found a lot of ways to share their collections with the public even when they couldn't open their doors. And some of those changes may stick around even as they reopen. It's the latest innovation in a long history of museums dating back to ancient times. Our next guest is exploring the history of the museum from ancient history to today and how the purpose of the museum has evolved over time and could continue to evolve during the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite modern day museum and why? What's one of the most unique, maybe unusual museums you've ever been to? Do you have a favorite local museum? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Laura Lee Brott is a PhD candidate studying medieval art at UW-Madison. Her interests range from architecture and cultural landscapes to cartography. She's teaching a course this summer called The History of the Museum, from prehistory to COVID-19. Laura Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
What do we know about, what we would consider to be the earliest museums?
Well, I think a lot of historians would argue that the first European museum came about in the time of the Renaissance, when we see the term museum first being used at around the 16th century, when world travel is sort of at a height and explorers are shipping back objects from places such as Mexico and the Yucatan Peninsula. And people in Europe are beginning to house these objects in cabinets called curio cabinets. In German, the term is Wunderkammer, a cabinet of curiosity. These objects inspired wonder in their European viewers because they were seeing things from lands and cultures that they couldn't even possibly imagine. Ritual objects from the Aztecs, for instance. And there's certainly a very dark history here about European expansion and colonization. But these objects were put into cabinets for either public or private viewing. And that's sort of where the museum space is born. And it takes off from there.
Well, hold on, though. Your class starts with prehistory. What kind of things could we regard as the, I guess, ancestors of that European version of the museum?
Yes, because the notion of a separate space for viewing objects or images, and I'm borrowing that clause from an article written by a contemporary art historian named Svetlana Alpers in an article that I would recommend called The Museum as a Way of Seeing in a book called Exhibiting Cultures. But this idea of attentive viewing goes way back to cave paintings, maybe even Egyptian tombs. And in my class, we're going to look at medieval Christian churches that have with decorated altar spaces as the focal points for pilgrims, with altars that house precious objects called reliquaries, which house the bones of a saint or a piece of his or her cloth. And getting close to that object was a way to get closer to God. So I'm sort of wondering about all of these ideas of viewing through multiple layers of history. So one of the goals of my summer class, the history of the museum, is to turn the timeline back and use that methodology to widen our scope of what a museum space means or signifies, because as we know today, museums serve very distinct purposes.
It all points to this idea that as humans, we take certain things, certain objects, and say, this means something. If I can quote Close Encounters, it's worth keeping around and it's worth looking at. I don't know. What do you think about that? I don't know if it's an instinct or something we've learned over the millennia, but that core concept seems to lie behind all of these different things we might call museums.
That's a very potent idea about what makes an object worthy of display. It makes me think of this concept of the Universal Survey Museum, which the Louvre, our National Gallery in DC and in London, the Met in New York. There's this idea that for a Universal Survey Museum, that the goal is to present a sort of broad range of art history. But that's where the questions really come. What types of objects do we see are worthy of representing a time or a group of people? How are those choices problematic or enlightening?
We're talking to Laura Lee Brott. She's teaching a course this summer called The History of the Museum from Prehistory to COVID-19 this summer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a museum fan? Do you have a favorite museum, big or small, you'd like to share with us? Do you work in a museum or volunteer in one yourself? Love to hear your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Laura Lee, you just mentioned some of the big names in the museum world, but I understand you're also a fan of smaller and more local museums. Can you tell us what you like about those and maybe share some of your favorites?
Yeah, sure. I spent some time along the Treasure Coast in South Florida somewhat recently. I was lucky enough to be able to go down there during all of this craziness. There was two massive royal shipwrecks about a mile or two off the coast. And the little treasure museums that are along the coast, it's Vero Beach and Sebastian, are just marvelous because they have a sort of connection to their local history that you can't really get at if you're going to see a shipwreck item in one of those museums I just mentioned, while an amazing experience, surely. But there's something very distinct about viewing those objects 1,000 feet from where they were found. So those are near and dear to my heart at the moment, the Treasure Coast museums in South Florida. There's tons around here that I look forward to seeing. I heard about a mustard museum in I think Middleton. I've seen there's a really wonderful one in Viroqua. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Mm-hmm. Their local history museum is fantastic as well. So yeah.
We heard from Darlene on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who shared the New Orleans Pharmacy Museum, called it small with a mighty impact and the reason to go to New Orleans. Also recommends the Arabia Steamboat Museum as a reason to visit Kansas City. So Darlene, clearly a fan of going to those local unique museums. And can you talk about a little bit about that? Like those treasure museums, Laura Lee, this is a museum that doesn't say, we're going to cover everything, even in our local community. We're going to specialize in this one point of interest.
Right. Yeah. I think that the wonderful benefit about having a focused museum is that you can really interrogate one singular narrative and really give it all of the different angles that it might deserve. Because it's kind of making me think about this question of what makes a good museum. And a good museum is one that's open to change. So I think that at the local level, that's something that could be accomplished maybe easier. Thinking about just the actual operational staff at the museum. That's actually a big strength that I would say of a local institution.
We're talking to Laura Lee Brott, PhD candidate studying medieval art at UW-Madison. And she's teaching a course this summer called The History of the Museum from Prehistory to COVID-19. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you love about museums? Have you missed being able to go into museums during COVID? Have you found cool online stuff along the way? Do you want to plug a cool local museum? You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll get to your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Laura Lee Brott, PhD candidate studying medieval art at UW-Madison. She's teaching a course this summer called The History of the Museum from Prehistory to COVID-19. We're talking about museums, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a museum fan, tell us what you like about them, the kind of things you like to see. Do you have a favorite local one? How has COVID changed everything? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I have been in many European museums. My specialties there would be the Pitti Palace in Florence and the Uffizi in Florence. The Pitti because of the magnificent Fulvii type of painting. But I have not really traveled much in the United States, and I'm age now 89, and I may not make it, but the museum I would really like to see in America is the Mutter Museum, which I believe is in Philadelphia, and it has to do with everything concerning man, the very essence of man, from the first embryo to a series of fetuses right up until the time of birth, and many other abnormalities that people have died from and suffered from. There's something magnificent to me about a museum featuring on man and not thinking about going to Mars. The Mutter Museum is really high on my list.
Interesting. Thank you so much, Nancy. I just looked it up. It's the Mutter Museum. It's like Mutter, but with a umlaut over the U's, and it's a museum of the College of Physicians in Philadelphia. Interesting. I wasn't familiar with that, Laura Lee, but that as an organizing principle for a museum. What do you think?
I love this museum so much, and it brings up a really good point about the fact that museums aren't just houses for art, but they're really educational institutions. So it's so fantastic to think about. It's a wonderful thing to think about these institutions existing, because they serve such an important role, which is to educate us on how material objects, whether they're art or not, I mean, vestiges of human exploration, can be used to navigate medical subjects. For somebody like me, I mean, my mom's a nurse, but I have trouble with biology. So it's really helpful to see the objects that physicians are using and the settings that they're in to understand those subjects. So I really appreciate that comment and that call.
Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Trevor next in Appleton. Trevor, hi.
Hey, Rob and Laura, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring here for you guys. It's a globally renowned museum in Two Rivers, Wisconsin, called Hamilton Woodtype and Printing Museum.
Wow.
It has garnered the interest of national software company Adobe, where they've actually, Adobe has gone in and actually hand scanned some of the wood type and made it available in the open source platform through Adobe's typeface library. So it's amazing just collection, and they've got amazing community outreach, but not as much recognition as, you know, you might think it should have in fine arts universities like, you know, School of the Art Institute of Chicago or Pratt or things like that. But I would highly, highly recommend your students to take a trip up to Two Rivers during this course, Laura, and see this museum. It's absolutely amazing. It's breathtaking. The fine art is world class.
Trevor, thanks a lot for the call. And I got to admit, my brother is a printer, and he's done talks there. My wife and kids have been there. My folks have been there. I still haven't been there myself, Trevor. So thanks for the nudge. I do appreciate it. Laura Lee, field trip.
Yeah, I really hope that's possible. That's one of the things. My class is actually online, so there's a little bit of a paradox there. But it's timely because of the setting that we're in right now with everything being online. But I cannot wait to step foot in that museum, whether it's with students or just myself. That looks fantastic.
And that also makes me think of the museum as a place that highlights more recent, you know, industrial era technology and things like that. I mean, there's Hamilton, there's science and industry in Chicago, Henry Ford in Dearborn, Michigan, the things that tell the story of, you know, the last couple few hundred years and technological development. There's quite a few of them, I guess, right?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, any historical or contemporary subject can be materialized and visualized. That is for sure. You can fill a house with objects related to any subject or issue. I would argue that as an art historian, for sure.
Thanks for the call, Trevor. Kate joins us also in Appleton. Kate, hello.
Hi. I am an educator in the Appleton area. And before I decided to go into teaching, I thought I was going to be going into education in an art museum. So I have had a lot of different experience. I have to say that Wisconsin has a plethora of really good interactive museums. I know in Milwaukee they have other hands-on ones. In the area that I live and where I grew up in Sheboygan, they have the John Michael Kohler Art Center, which has like really nice tours. They have artist-in-residence programs. And really, if you have any sort of interest, there is probably some sort of internship out there that you would be able to do. I've also worked at the Payne Art Center and Gardens. So even if you like to be more outside, there's lots of other interactive things as well as field trips. So like, basically, if you can think of it, there's a museum that's going to be out there for you. And that's what I love about museums and how education pairs so well with them.
Fantastic, Kate. Thank you so much for sharing this. And Laura Lee, she mentioned the word interactive a couple times. And it seems like since I was a kid, you know, you'd go to a museum, there's a thing on a wall and maybe a little note by it. And that's your interactive. You lean in and read the note. Museums have gone a long way to make things more interactive and educational, at least in my personal experience, Adam. Is that something that's actually going on?
Yeah, and I think that that's probably, too, a result of the different medias that were offered. At my master's institution at University of North Texas, there's a new media program there, which electronics. I remember walking up a set of stairs and different notes on a piano were playing. And it's really a response to the different types of materials that artists are now being inspired by and working with, and then museums as spaces to respond to the types of needs that these objects require, like a set of stairs.
Kate, thank you so much for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Laura Lee Brott. She's teaching a course at UW-Madison this summer called The History of the Museum. Laura Lee, before we go back to our callers, COVID-19 obviously changed a lot of institutions, including museums. What kind of changes did you see there? Are there things you think might stick around?
So I feel like there was one big collective breath in when it all started. How are we going to move forward? In a weird way, our technology was ready for us to live digitally. And museums have sort of just taken that on. I mean, during the pandemic, many of us have sort of looked inward, and museums as institutions have done the same. I was actually in a workshop yesterday with the National Gallery, hearing from conservators who are diving into their artifacts to the microscopic level using remote sensing technologies and just unearthing as much information as they can using these digital technologies to then be able to show to our audiences. So we have this sort of entering now the sort of superhuman awareness of our art objects that are available online, which is a very distinct experience rather than seeing it in person. So I think that as we maybe can release our breath, we can start to, I think we'll begin to see how the two will come together. It's pretty exciting.
Let's go back to our callers now. John is with us in Heartland. John, hi.
Hi. I was just traveling today out in southwest Wisconsin, and I heard Viroqua, one of my favorite towns, being mentioned. And I thought of Potosi, the Potosi Beer Museum and Brewery. That was actually a nonprofit brewery. It was actually funded by the state of Wisconsin and I believe the Department of Tourism. And it was a set of buildings that were really run down. And a local artist, I believe, donated a good chunk of the acreage that he owned to form this nonprofit, and it has revived the town and is really a fun place to go if you're into the history of the brewers, not just throughout Wisconsin, but through different areas. I believe they're a pretty big walkthrough brewery, and actually the artist was a woodworker and made a lot of the things throughout the brewery that are like the bar. There's a bar and restaurant attached, and there's other artisans that are around the brewery now too. It's a wonderful place for a day trip.
Sounds That's great. Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Yeah, Laura Lee, go ahead.
I love the idea of museums sort of being in different types of environments, such as a brewery, where you can actually experience the beer that's being made and then think about the historical context in which the setting that you're in and how it was made too. So I think that's really cool.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We'll go to Judith next in Burlington. Judith, hello.
Hi, I'm calling you from two small offbeat museums in downtown Burlington, the Spinning Top and Yo-Yo Museum and the Logic Puzzle Museum. They're separate museums, but they're both hands-on, and it turns out that adults like them as much as the kids.
Wow, and do you get to do logic puzzles in the one and play with, and fail, or in my case, fail to play with yo-yos in the other?
Well, the Logic Puzzle Museum, yes, there's 60 hands-on brain teaser puzzles to use and an exhibit, of course, in a collection. The Spinning Top and Yo-Yo Museum has hands-on tops. We don't have hands-on yo-yos, but we have lots of yo-yos in the exhibit. So there's lots of fun, and there's a show and hands-on and exhibit and I Spy Hunt. It's a whole program and tour when you come to the Top Museum.
I love it, Judith. Thanks a lot for sharing this. Pretty specific here, Laura Lee, but a fun theme for both of them.
I love it so much. That's the best interactive museum I've ever heard of.
That sounds like a great time. Time for one more caller, I think. Patrick is with us in Eau Claire. Patrick, hi.
Hi, this is Patrick from Eau Claire. I would like to recommend the National Musical Instrument Museum in Vermilion, South Dakota. They have thousands of musical instruments. They can only display a handful of their collection. You need to set aside a couple of days if you're going to go see it, if you want to see everything. And I was there a few years ago, but I believe they've expanded it now, so it's even bigger than it was. So you may need more than a couple of days. You'll need at least 2 days to see if you want to see everything. They got music instruments all over the world. They got famous instruments owned by like Johnny Cash, Elvis Presley. There's a whole section about guitars. Whatever your musical interest is, you'll find it at the National Music Instrument Museum in Vermilion, South Dakota.
Patrick, thanks a lot for the call. Laura Lee, just under a minute left. I don't know, how do you curate your class given all the museums out there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm going by topic, actually, and I'm also opening it up to the students so they can sort of pick and choose sort of like today, you know, what's your favorite or what's your, you know, something that really inspires you. So yeah, it's really topic based. At the end of the class, I'll be bringing in an artist as sort of one of my conclusion lectures, because that's sort of where we're at today in terms of, you know, what are museums showing and who are the people that need them.
Laura Lee, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Laura Lee Brott, PhD candidate in medieval art at UW-Madison. We talked to her about her course she's teaching this summer, The History of the Museum, from Prehistory to COVID-19. Keep sharing your favorites on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, the Museum of You. We want to hear about your most prized and meaningful objects. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, locally grown food, organic versus commercial, healthy versus unhealthy. There's a lot of info out there about the food we eat, but Kate Archer Kent says a lot of the stuff going around is wrong. Meet the author of the new book, Resetting the Table. That's tomorrow morning at 8 on The Morning Show. Now, a coffee mug, a worn-in t-shirt, a painting on the wall. All objects in our lives, no matter how ordinary or unusual, have the potential to have personal value, according to our next guest. There can be a lot of different reasons why something might have meaning. Maybe someone made it for you, or someone special gave it to you. You got it at a time in your life that was significant. It was the most money you ever spent on something. It was owned by someone special before you. It has a story. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Whether it's something you use every day or something you never touch, what object is important in your life? If there was a museum of you, what would be the main item on display? Does it have a story? Is there a family heirloom or hand-me-down that you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We asked around here at Wisconsin Public Media and got some great stories. Larry Mueller says, I have many fishing tackle boxes, but I never use the oldest one. It's filled with the oldest overworked lures I own. The box and lures are past their prime, but not the memories they hold. The lure I used to catch my first 40-inch muskie, the the time I accidentally knocked the tackle box in the water while trying to catch a big muskie, the lure of a magazine photo of me with a large muskie caught in the fall. All muskies for Larry. It's the oldest box of lures I own, but wouldn't part with it for any money. Christine Harold is a professor of communication at the University of Washington. Her most recent book is called Things Worth Keeping, The Value of Attachment in a Disposable World. Christine, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I know from our last conversation, you think a lot about our connections with things. Are there items in your life, Christine, that you consider, I don't know, like an heirloom, a personal treasure of some sort?
Absolutely. So I write a little bit about mine in my book, and it's I call him Pooh Bear, and it's an old Winnie the Pooh that I was given maybe about 49 years ago by a friend of my mom's when I was a toddler, and he's very well worn, barely hanging in there, but I slept with him for many, many years, and now he has a prized place on top of a shelf in my closet.
I guess mine would be my saxophone, my tenor saxophone. I got it when it was clear that I was going to keep playing after high school, and I got it from a guy who had played it in the Mercer Ellington Orchestra, the Stan Kenton Orchestra. It was like it's 100 years old or so now. It's not the most valuable thing in the world, and it's pretty beat up looking. But yeah, it's got a history. It's got a big connection with my life. If there's something I'd be bummed to lose, that would probably be it. I don't know. There's so many different reasons, Christine, that somebody might feel a connection to things big or small. Can you talk about a few of the things that make an item the one we want to keep?
Yeah, you know, I'm happy to talk about that. And it's not just one thing. You know, I think that the first thing we think of is oftentimes those sentimental objects, like your saxophone and Pooh Bear for me, and, you know, those sorts of things that maybe they were handed down from a loved one, or maybe, you know, like I also, I have this pair of Levi's, 501 Levi's that I've had for many, many years. I haven't worn them in a long time. We won't go into why, but you know, they traveled with me to Europe. I wore them in college, and, you know, they have stains and tears that kind of tell a story of their own, you know, so there's those objects that we kind of imprint our stories on, but then there's lots of other reasons that aren't quite as romantic. So for example, a lot of times we keep things because they have some kind of group affiliation, right? People might think, well, I'm a Nike kind of person, right? And in fact, product designers will talk about product variants, like a particular kind of Nike, like Air Jordan or something, and then product specimens, your particular pair of Air Jordans that have the wear and tear of use in your life. They take on patterns of use. And so brands, you know, try very hard to get us to imprint on a particular variant of an object, but it takes on more meaning as we live with it, use it, and so on. Other times things just, you know, we see them as self-expression. Like, I'm a person who likes Chuck Taylors, or I'm a person who likes Vans, right? That you kind of identify with things in that way. Other things are just pleasurable to use. They have a nice interface, or they might not have an efficient interface, but there's something about using them or wearing them that give us pleasure in some way. So there's lots of ways that objects can come to mean, but studies do show that memory is probably the strongest, that makes some things indispensable and others that we can more readily discard.
We're talking to Christine Harold from the University of Washington, author of the book Things Worth Keeping, The Value of Attachment in a Disposable World. We're talking about the things we keep as keepsakes, things we have a special connection with, objects that tell a story about themselves and maybe about us or a loved one. You could join in with yours at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Wendy is with us in Algoma. Wendy, hi.
Hello.
Hi. What did you want to tell us about, Wendy?
Well, I lost my daughter in 1995, and I collect angels, and I have goosebumps just talking about it. So I have a showcase of angels, and it's very special to me, and also rainbows, because the day I lost her, a rainbow was outside.
Oh. Wendy, I'm sorry for your loss, and I'm glad you shared that. Can I ask, Wendy, were you able to ever visit the Angel Museum in Beloit? They closed, I think, a couple few years ago.
I'm sorry I lost you there.
The Angel Museum in Beloit? Did you ever go there?
No.
Oh, well, they've closed. I'm sorry. But, Wendy, thank you so much for sharing that story.
Beautiful.
And, again, sorry for the loss of your daughter. But I imagine, Christine, that's a common story, something we connect to a lost loved one, as Wendy's angels do.
Absolutely. So we would talk about those kinds of items. Certainly, maybe there's a memory attached to them for Wendy, but it's also that they become a symbol, right? That they become significant in that they signify, right? They represent something for her and her daughter and her hope that her daughter is with angels, is an angel, right? And that they become kind of signs that stand in for something that in this case, tragically absent. And so that's a really powerful, powerful kind of significant object. In addition to the fact that when we start a collection, then in the aggregate, those objects become all the more valuable as a collection rather than kind of on their own. So that's kind of doubly powerful what Wendy's talking about.
Thanks again for calling in, Wendy. Let's go to Amber with us now in Green Bay. Amber, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What item did you want to share with us, Amber?
So I wanted to share the story of my great-grandmother's teacup. It's a teacup and saucer set from my great-grandma who immigrated in 1906. I just moved into a 60-foot square space trailer, and it was one of the items I couldn't bring myself to let go, even though I don't have a functional use for it.
Wow. So do you keep it kind of on display, Amber, where you could see it all the time, or do you just keep it kind of tucked away but you know you have it?
I keep it on the counter, and it holds my chapsticks, but I just couldn't let go of it.
I gotcha, Amber. Thank you so much. So this item, yeah, part of her family history, but also, you know, something as fragile as a teacup survived the trip to the United States and a century past that. What do you think, Christine?
Yeah, I would be interested to hear kind of what the meaning that it holds for Amber. It's interesting, you know, that there are some things like chinaware, for example, that gets oftentimes passed down generation to generation. And sometimes, as is all, I'm ashamed to say, a great-grandmother's china is in a cardboard box on a shelf, mm-hmm, in my home. I would never get rid of it, but it's not something that I have on display. Whereas other items that we inherit or that just remind us of somebody, you know, one of our ancestors, that those are very, that they take on a meaning. Maybe they represent exactly what you just said about the coming to the United States, and that this grandmother obviously also valued it enough to wrap it and put it in her luggage and carry it with her. So it clearly held meaning for her as well. And it's interesting how an individual object, its own meaning, it has a story that's independent of any one of us. So it might have meant one thing to the grandmother, mm-hmm, and now means something else to her granddaughter, to Amber. And so that's just an interesting ways in which objects really have a history that's in some ways independent of us. Like, we cross paths with them, but we're just their steward for a period of time, and then they go on to the next person, ideally.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Amber. We're talking to Christine Harold, professor of communication at the University of Washington. Her most recent book is Things Worth Keeping, The Value of Attachment in a Disposable World. We're talking about prized possessions and family heirlooms, things that we feel that attachment with. You can share yours at 800-642-1234. What stuff in your life is meaningful? Is there a prized possession, big or small, expensive or otherwise, maybe a family connection, something important to your personal life, your personal story? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Christine Harold, author of the book Things Worth Keeping, The Value of Attachment in a Disposable World. We're talking about the things, the stuff that you find value in, that you feel a connection to. you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is something that you value? What's your most prized possession? What's the story behind it? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Paul is with us in Sorona. Paul, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to share with us, Paul?
Something I'll probably hand down to my son. I've been a carpenter all my life, and back in 1976, my wife-to-be bought me a hammer when we graduated vocational school, and I'm using the same one to this day. So I think just the fact that I never lost it has some value to myself and my son. So, but yeah, those small little things mean a lot to people. It's a great program too, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for calling in. I want to ask, like, what does it mean to you when you pull out that hammer that has survived, what is it now, 4.5 decades in your hands? What does it mean to you to pull it out and work with it?
Well, I'm not really sure because I can lose my glasses any given moment in my life, but it somehow it does have some meaning to it, and somehow it survived with as many tools as one uses in a lifetime, and I don't know. I just take the pride. I've kept something all these years. I mean, it's probably the fourth on my list, besides my wife and my kids. But pretty important, yes.
I love it. Paul, thank you so much. Glad the wife and kids are still ahead of the hammer, though. Christine, yeah, I don't know. Longevity, it's practical. It's the connection with his wife. So much going on there.
Absolutely. I mean, his wife gave it to him, which is valuable. It's useful, right? So it has a utilitarian function, but it's more than that for him. I think for Paul, it's the ultimate durable good, a hammer. It's not going anywhere. And there's really no, we're not going to, see a hammer 2.0 necessarily. It does its job. It's not going to be, outdated in that sense. There's just something very simple about that tool that I think is really, I think a really interesting example in all kinds of ways. It's like you just can't really improve on the design of a good hammer.
Paul, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Let's go next to Anne in Janesville. Anne, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about Anne?
So when my husband and I were dating, he would use the straw wrappers from our, drink straws to make little people. He actually learned to make straw men from his dad, and I have kept every little straw man that he made throughout the whole time we were dating. We've been married almost 22 years now, and now and again he'll make me little straw men. And so I have all from when we were dating, all the ones from our marriage so far. And he taught my kids how to make them, and my daughter and son have both made me a few. So I had it's like a small purse with little straw men with various dates on them, and those are just priceless mementos.
I love it. Anne, I got to ask, though, those straw wrappers are pretty fragile. How have you kept those intact all these years?
Actually, several of them, we had a laminating machine at one point when the kids were much smaller. I stuck them on a laminating thing. But you can also get the self-laminating sheets. Those work too. But they're not really handled very often because they are, you're right, they can start coming unwound. But they're super cute.
I love it. Thank you, Anne, so much for sharing that. So some romance in that one, Christine.
Yeah, definitely romance. And what's also very cool about Anne's example is that there is actually a lot of artists and eco designers, people who are thinking about what can we do with just all of those little things that would otherwise end up just being trash. And there's so many artists either with an kind of ecological frame or just people who are interested in kind of taking those mass produced everyday items that are just, a straw wrapper on its own is just the most utterly mundane object. And yet through the application of a little artistic skill and talent, her husband transformed it into these keepsakes. And so I think that's a really powerful and interesting example of something that artists are exploring all the time these days with how can we take those things that are sort of otherwise discarded and turn them into something meaningful?
Thank you so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Christine Harold from the University of Washington, author of the book Things Worth Keeping, talking about the things in your life that you have found to be worth keeping, that keepsake from a family member maybe, or something that has a lot of meaning in your own personal life. You could join in with yours at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Richard in Wauwatosa. Richard, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have an interesting one. I come from a family of avid cribbage players, and I happen to be the lucky owner or steward of both of my grandfather's cribbage boards, one of which was handmade by him. So I feel very fortunate, and my wife and I use those cribbage boards almost daily.
And Richard, I think a lot of people might face the decision, you know, we've got this thing, we cherish it. Do we put it up on display or do we actually play the game on it? You went with playing the game on it, and I would too. What made you say, yeah, this isn't a museum piece, we're going to use this thing?
Well, I tell you what, they are meant to be used. You know, they're made out of wood. I've had to make new pegs for them over the years, but they're kind of a thing that I don't feel would ever wear out. So we may as well use them and enjoy them.
Richard, thanks for sharing that. And Christine, I know cribbage boards here can be like objects of folk art, definitely. Mm-hmm. And Richard, and I love that he said he's the steward of them, not the owner of them.
Exactly. And that's actually an argument that I make in the book, is to encourage this sense of stewardship for the durable objects in our lives. And the thing that's great about this example of the cribbage board is that A, it's handmade. And I think for a lot of people, you know, there was a couple of major design movements in the 20th century that both were responding to the new factory model of production. And some went hardcore toward the factory and said, yes, we're going to democratize objects for everyday people. But others went the other direction and really prioritized the handmade. Even those things that showed little imperfections as part of their beauty, because it showed they were like documents of the labor process, right? The document of, you know, however many days his grandfather, Richard's grandfather, spent crafting this thing, let alone Richard going on to, you know, then iterate on it in his own way and repair it over time and so on. So it's that, but then also wooden objects in particular take on, you know, they kind of take on little dings and, you know, the edges soften through use. And so, again, it's that kind of imprinting over time that I think really intensifies the value for people.
Time for one more caller. Tricia is with us in Sauk City. Tricia, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What item did you want to tell us about?
Well, I have my grandmother's pestle and mortar, and it's just something that I hold really dear to my heart. Her and my grandfather purchased it on a trip to New Mexico many, many years ago, and she recently passed this winter. But being a self-taught forager and apothecary, and it's something that I use regularly between my apothecary and cooking with my children, I cherish it.
Tricia, thank you so much for sharing that. Christine, just half a minute or so left. Some final thoughts to leave us with.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really struck by these examples. You know, we have a mortar and pestle, a game, cribbage, hammer, teacup. These are all really bodily. I mean, these are tools and games that engage the body, right? These aren't just kind of images on a screen. These are things that we hold in our hand, that people potentially that who we knew and loved held in their hands or even crafted with their own hands. There's something about all of these examples, I think, that's really illustrates the importance of real world, tangible, durable objects. And I think that they become even more precious in a time when so much of our lives exist virtually.
Christine, thanks so much for joining us again.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Christine Harold, professor of communication at the University of Washington. She's the author of the book Things Worth Keeping. You can keep sharing your keepsakes over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Used car prices are through the roof lately. We'll find out what's driving high demand and low supply and what you need to know if you're in the market for a new old car. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Hey, you know what? I had so many great stories for our colleagues here at Wisconsin Public Media about their cherished artifacts in their lives. Let's read a couple. Margaret Bechtol with the Educational Communications Board says she lived in Berlin, Germany in the late 1980s. Her apartment was near a section of wall on the southwest edge of the city where she could hear gunshots from guard towers and people tried to escape. And she says, "I'll never forget the euphoria of November 9th, 1989. A jar of fragments of the wall that I chiseled myself has sat in my mantle ever since. I've never been able," she says, "to adequately express the scope of emotion surrounding that event to anyone that did not share those days with me. Everything felt changed." Clint Walls of PBS Wisconsin says his most prized thing is his leather-bound collection of 515 George Brett baseball cards, which he collected from first grade, 1981, to 1999. I understand he got to show those to George Brett. Felt like a bit of a stalker. Ezra Wall from our southwestern Wisconsin region says, "In a plastic tub in the far recesses of my storage unit, there lives a 42-year-old stuffed puppy given to me by my late grandfather when I was in the hospital with a broken leg." Ezra says, 78 or 79, significantly deteriorated, missing an eye and an ear, no longer recognizable as a puppy. It's the only item he owns, Ezra says, that he knows for sure was from his grandfather. Well, again, keep sharing your heirlooms, your favorite items over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.